seemed like it would, very well be a title. And it's, reasonably true, but this is more or less what the title really should probably be. But this term substochastic is probably one that most people haven't really heard. It's not used very much. And I'm going to be talking quite a bit about it during this talk. So this has been, in varying degrees, joint work with Stephen Jordan, Brad Lackey, and Aaron Ostrander. And all three of them are at Quix. They have other affiliations too, but I'm not the world's best LaTeX artist, and so this was the way I could get all of that information on one slide. And so the work can be found partially in these two places and this archive paper, which was submitted to a math journal and so has, been under review for the past like 16 months or whatever. So adiabatic optimization, it's currently of quite a bit of interest. I guess I'm walking from the screen. And what we do is it's an algorithm that basically takes you from a Hamiltonian where you know how to prepare the ground state, and it slowly evolves it, typically by a function that looks something like this, into some final Hamiltonian, H1, where the ground state's going to encode the solution to some optimization problem that you might be interested in. Hopefully you are interested in it, otherwise you shouldn't be doing this in the first place. And so the runtime, to have the adiabatic theorem apply, you basically need to evolve things slowly. But there's a question of how slowly is slowly. And the typical way people look at this is through the adiabatic theorem in terms of the spectral gap of the Hamiltonian. And so the spectral gap is the difference, the difference in the two lowest eigenvalues of the Hamiltonian. And depending upon the process, it could also be the two highest eigenvalues of the Hamiltonian if you're looking at a stochastic process. But for us, it's the two lowest. And gamma in this expression is the minimal spectral gap. So consider this entire interpolation. You could have other paths. This doesn't have to be a straight linear interpolation, whatever. But you're just going to look for wherever the spectral gap is minimized. And that's going to be the point at which you evaluate this expression. And it scales like, something over 1 over gap squared. And actually, there's some norm of the Hamiltonian or derivative of the Hamiltonian term that comes in there. For the cases that we've been working with, we usually just consider that being 1. And we control what that norm is. But something to be aware of. It can factor in. OK. Now, typically, people compare this to simulated annealing. That seems to be the going trend. And simulated annealing is basically I guess they call it a meta-heuristic. Or it's really this heuristic algorithm by which you just you have a particle, and it's trying to find some minimum. You do this by gradually lowering its temperature, and it hopefully settles down into what you hope is the global minimum for your problem. But it has the prospect of getting trapped in not a global minimum, but rather a local minimum. And so people believe that adiabatic optimization might get you out of this problem because you can tunnel out of a local minimum into the global minimum, at least in theory. OK. Now, it might offer speed up through tunneling. Maybe not. I guess one of my goals of this talk, and I mean, I have a couple agendas, but one agenda is to pretty much convince you that that's not actually good intuition, that tunneling is really not, in this case, a quantum phenomenon. And the other thing is we're interested in stochastic Hamiltonians, and these are of interest currently. And what that basically means is your Hamiltonian is something where diagonal elements or whatever they are, the off-diagonal elements are all non-positive. Okay. And my second agenda is to replace this word stochastic with substochastic. I have more agendas, but OK. So what is a stochastic Hamiltonian really? Well, it's something that you can write is basically the sum of a graph Laplacian and some diagonal potential. This is in the computational basis. And so what a graph Laplacian is it basically assigns to each diagonal element the degree of some particular vertex. So here you've got some vertex. It has degree 1. It's got one edge coming from it, so it gets a 1. You have some other vertex. It's got degree 2. It's got two edges coming from it. It gets 2, so on and so forth. On the other end, this has degree 1. And now graph Laplacians have the critical feature that the row, well, undirected graph Laplacians have the critical feature that the row and column sums basically are zero. Okay, so whatever weights you have for these edges coming out, so that could be 1/2, then the degree of that vertex would be 1/2, so that the rows sum to zero. And so we're considering the really general picture where this is just any weighted Laplacian, and this is some diagonal matrix. And one way to think of this diagonal matrix is like a transverse field, right? So this is some potential function. So you just look at the vertices at this vertex, its potential is 1, this vertex potential 2, 0. So this is actually the solution right here to our optimization problem if we were actually running this as an optimization algorithm, 6 and 10. Okay. So this is the kind of matrix that we're currently... Yep.
So obviously the general stochastic matrix, the off-diagonal turns out to be minus 1.
Right, yeah.
So you're allowing what weights on the edge?
Yes. So basically when they aren't minus 1, I just chose minus 1 because it was kind of the easiest thing to write, but it could be negative W. And you know, you would just, whatever you do, this diagonal term should be the right number to cancel out whatever else you got. But you can see that this, you know, covers the entire class of things you'd be varying through, right? Because you can just introduce however small these weights are. So if you have some 1 minus S here, you know, as long as it's still satisfying, it all works out. Okay. So why do I want to call these things substochastic? Why am I not happy with the stochastic terminology? Well, I think probably in the abstract I mentioned I was going to talk quite a bit about heat diffusion. Okay, so we're going to drop this Hamiltonian into the heat diffusion equation, and then we can just consider the infinitesimal representation of it, where you have psi t plus dt equals the identity minus delta t ht psi t. Okay, and the first thing you notice is that if you take delta t sufficiently small, so for this class of matrices that we just described, take delta t sufficiently small, every entry is going to be between 0 and 1, right? So, I mean, this is almost trivial because there's always a delta t or a dt, whatever, that satisfies that. And the other condition is that basically the identity minus dt times your Hamiltonian, the row sums are always less than or equal to 1. Okay, so they're not quite a probability, they don't quite give you a stochastic process because they don't equal 1, but they're giving you a substochastic process. They don't exceed 1. And so what this looks like is something like this. So in this case, this is the matrix we were just looking at for that particular graph. And what I've done here is I've just chosen delta t to be 1/11th. And I chose it, you know, with malice aforethought. Because basically what I want to say is that, okay, let's sum up this row. And this is going to give us 10. So the total sum here is 10/11ths, 9/11ths. This one actually sums to 11, right? So the total there is 1. And then you've got 5 here, so 5/11ths, and then 1/11th down here. And this corresponds to a very nice picture, which is this one. And so what we have here is... the same graph that we started with, except now we've transformed things into this bigger picture with what is known as a host graph. So pretend for a moment this isn't a tombstone. Okay, so we call this whole thing the host graph. The original problem was a subgraph of the host graph. And basically these extra things that were left over, so if you look back, we were missing 1/11th here. That's how short we were of our total probability. That is going to be the weight of this edge. And so on and so forth. This one had nothing left over, so it's disconnected from the tombstone, what we call the cemetery state. This is 6/11ths, this is 10/11ths, so on and so forth. You know, you probably have a bigger graph, but you hook them all back up to the cemetery state. And so now what you've got is basically a stochastic process where your walker is just going to die with probability assigned by its transition rate into the cemetery. Okay, so you've just got this stochastic process, walkers transition to the cemetery, and then they cease to exist. Okay, so we want to go and apply this stuff to do a few things. The first thing is we're going to discuss spectral gaps. Now, this problem is found everywhere. It's not just something that you're going to want to use in the case of adiabatic optimization. It's also going to give you some knowledge about quantum phase transitions in condensed matter physics, in the context of graph theory and also in the context of differential geometry. These will give you what are known as isoparametric inequalities, so inequalities that basically tell you how much volume you can capture in a certain surface area. And that's often an important thing to know. And in the context of heat diffusion and stochastic processes or substochastic processes, this basically tells you how rapidly whatever your distribution is at the moment approaches what is referred to as your stationary distribution, or in the case of a substochastic process, a quasi-stationary distribution, because it still will decay with time, but it'll just be steady. So in other words, how quickly does some function approach the ground state eigenvector or eigenfunction? So these are considered in a few different ways. Within the physics literature, you pretty much see only two arise, at least, well, sorry, within the quantum computing and quantum information literature, you pretty much see only two arise. Cheeger inequalities and Poincaré inequalities are pretty much the limit of what people have explored. And Cheeger is going to be pretty important for our intuition. Poincaré, I'm not going to talk about, but it's worth noting that it's out there. But then you've got these other inequalities. You've got Sobolev inequalities, which are something like Cheeger inequalities on steroids. So they give you isoparametric inequalities, and Cheeger is one type of that. Harnack inequalities, which give you a relationship between your spectral gap or some eigenvalue and the gradient of the function introduced onto this graph or whatever you have. And heat kernel methods are really, really powerful, but they're also incredibly difficult to actually do. You don't want to mess around with them. Then there's some new stuff. There's variational inequalities, which were introduced by Levine in 94 to prove the fundamental gap conjecture in one dimension. And so those seem to have limited utility. We've applied them in this setting to get some optimal bounds, but you know, I don't know how far they extend. And then there's this new stuff, this heat diffusion inequalities. And these were introduced by Andrews and Clutterbuck very recently. To fully prove the same thing that Levine was chasing after, the fundamental gap theorem. And okay, so I also promised you some classical simulation. Well, we're going to see that not only do these heat diffusion inequalities or heat diffusion methods give us some really powerful insight into what's going on in terms of the spectral gap and also in terms of these adiabatic processes, but we're going to see that we can actually use that intuition pretty directly to construct an algorithm for simulating quantum adiabatic optimization. Okay. At least in the stochastic case. There should have been the word stochastic up there, or substochastic, if you will. Okay, so this is really up here just for everyone's benefit so that we're speaking the same language. This is going to go away, and I'm never going to talk about it again unless you read my paper. But when you have this host graph, the eigenvalues of this host graph are clearly not the same as the eigenvalues of our Hamiltonian. And the way you get from one to the other is you consider what are known as the Dirichlet eigenvalues. And so that's basically this Rayleigh quotient where you take the infimum over all possible functions u that satisfy a particular boundary constraint. And in this case, that boundary constraint is basically the simple boundary constraint that function should be zero at the gravesite. So when you're at the symmetry state, it should be zero. That's your boundary condition. And the spectral gap, or I'm sorry, the difference in the two lowest solutions to this is the spectral gap of your Hamiltonian. So that actually gives you, you know, exactly what you want. But now we're speaking pure graph theory, and we're no longer talking about substochastic Hamiltonians or stochastic Hamiltonians. So this is the first place where we get some really solid intuition as to what's going on, and the first place where I talk about something that's really quantum. So this is the one that's primarily used in the physics literature, and here's a bunch of math that is up there if you're interested, but the intuition is really all we care about for the purposes of this talk. And so what you have is you have the Cheeger inequality basically tells you how bottlenecked your graph is. So classically, it's really easy to imagine. You've got something like this. Imagine a walker over here. How long is it going to take that walker to get over here? Well, if there were lots of connections, you know, between these sites, it would happen rather rapidly. But because there's this bottleneck, there's only one path that can connect one side of the graph to the other. It's going to take that walker a long time. So that's what a bottleneck is. And it's basically expressed by this chi green inequality. So phi expresses how bottlenecked your graph is. So if you can take a razor and just cut your graph into two very large things, separated by some small region, so this is that you make a cut, and you know you can actually do that, you get some value for your Cheeger constant or your conductance, or it goes under a bunch of different names. But this basically gives you both an upper and lower bound on your spectral gap. Now, in the quantum setting, we have something kind of different occur because we do have these potentials that can exist on the vertices. And here's an example of where you get a bottleneck, but the original graph didn't really have such a terrible bottleneck. So we have this caterpillar graph here, and it is what it is. And we have this same caterpillar graph here. And we're going to put this potential on it. And this potential is convex in some particular representation. If you follow any path straight across here, it's convex. And if you follow the path down the spine, it's convex. So we can consider this a convex potential. So the optimization problem on this particular graph should be pretty easy. But what happens is this potential induces this particular ground state, which has this exponentially small bottleneck. So the bottleneck now is in the ground state. So we're no longer talking about the simple case where the bottleneck corresponds to just the connectivity of the graph. It's actually also weights on it that get induced by the ground state. So the ground state of your Hamiltonian is actually going to give you some sort of geometry that you need to pay attention to for your graph. And now the other thing that you want to keep in mind is that, and a lot of people kind of miss this, is that Cheeger inequalities work both ways. So not only does a large spectral gap, not only does a large Cheeger constant imply a large spectral gap, so large bottleneck implies small spectral gap, but it works the other way too. A large spectral gap is going to say that you don't have such a bottleneck. So in your quantum case, you can consider your ground state. You know, you don't have a bottleneck, or you do. That's basically what the spectral gap is telling you, is this, you know, geometry of your actual ground state of the Hamiltonian. Okay. Now this is where you really got to bear with some technical gore for, I guess, four or so slides. So here, what we're going to do is we want to calculate the spectral gap. And I already told you that we don't want to think about quantum mechanics at the moment. We just want to think about heat diffusion. So if you think back to, say, your undergraduate course in differential equations or something, you know that if you have the initial value problem for this particular heat diffusion process, right, that it's going to have the general solution given by this expression here. Okay? So basically, we can write it this way. This ratio here, and whenever I write these ratios, is a vector component-wise ratio, right? So this is, you know, alpha 1, 1 over alpha 0, 1, and so on and so forth. And then we're just going to look at this particular portion of it, which is the portion in parentheses, right? So we're going to factor out the ground state portion. And what this gives you is basically an expression of how rapidly you are going to approach the ground state, which isn't exactly the steady state in this case, but it's decaying uniformly in time, right? So it's what we would call quasi-stationary. How rapidly do your oscillations from that, your spatial oscillations, damp out? Okay. And the way we're going to do that is by taking a look at how this looks at in a more geometric graph theory kind of way, which is where we again consider heat diffusion. Nothing changed there. But now we actually write this out component-wise. So this is the ith component of the phi vector. And this is what it looks like. This is the term that you get just from having a negative w. So that's just what it is. It's diagonal. You only get the wy component. And then you get this. And this is your typical expression for the action of the Laplacian on an arbitrary vector. So if you take L and you act on an arbitrary vector, you get this thing. So now what you can do is keep in mind that f that we had, which was basically whatever function we were considering over the ground state. Well, let's rewrite it, and let's just see how that diffuses in time. And I'm not going to give you the technical details for that because it's long. But you wind up with this expression. And this is exactly the expression that you would expect out of basically the action of a weighted directed graph on this function f. Okay. So what the ground state is doing here, what the potential function is doing, is it's basically taking your ground state and re-representing that as a weighting function for your graph that gives you like a particular direction you're going to flow with a particular strength. Now, an important thing to note is that if you can get a handle on what the gradient is of your ground state at any given, you know, well, whatever, if you can get a handle on the gradient of your ground state, then you can actually, you know, think about this thing entirely in graph theoretic terms. You don't need to really worry so much about what the genuine quantum process is. Okay, so I said we want to study the spatial oscillations, and we want to study them for the purpose of basically getting an idea of what our spectral gap is. And in order to do that, we need some, well, far more high-powered machinery than what we're probably accustomed to. And so what I'm going to introduce is known as the modulus of continuity. And typically, this measures the how continuous a function is. But in this case, well, I mean, it's kind of funny to use this in a discrete setting, but it winds up being really powerful. And you know, if it works, it works. So let's just go ahead and use it. And what it basically is if you consider a function f, so here's f, and here's x, and just for simplicity, let's make it a sign. It's going to basically tell you what the magnitude or how big your spatial oscillations can possibly get. Right, so this is the absolute largest it can get. So for any a and b separated by a particular distance, in this case, let's pretend the distance is going to be the easy one to visualize, the distance between here and here, call that s. Right, eta is some number that's got to be larger than whatever the difference between these two points is. Now, for our purposes, we want to choose a modulus of continuity specifically that is actually achieved, right? So ours, in this example, would return, if this is 1 and this is minus 1, we would take eta of s equal to 2. So for us, we would want eta of s being 2. And that's because we want this thing to actually be achieved. And we want it to be monotonic. So, you know, if your spatial oscillations do something funky, we're just going to ignore those points and just consider, you know, as things get farther apart, what's the absolute biggest, you know, you would consider if you were looking over that range. And to see, you know, you just kind of scan back and forth by s, and this is always going to pick out positive values because we're looking at the supremum, right? So you can always swap y and x to make the thing positive, and that's always bigger. And so this is the main tool that we're going to use to prove a few theorems. So here's a motivating example, the hypercube. And so the hypercube is a really great example because you have a three-line proof that the spectral gap of the hypercube is larger than 2. And the spectral gap of the hypercube actually is 2, so this is optimal. And the way you do this is you just look back at your heat diffusion process. This set K that I've got is known as the edge-generating set. So presumably everyone is familiar with the hypercube being represented in terms of bit strings. So what A does is A just flips a particular bit. So if you have, say, the bit string 0, 0, 0, and you act on it with A0, that would give you 1, 0, 0. Okay, and this K is just the set of all possible bits you can potentially flip. And so, okay, that's what the notation means. So consider now the Y and the X that actually achieve the supremum for eta at a Hamming distance of 2. So basically, consider all bit strings that are separated by a Hamming distance of 2, and look at the modulus that achieves, modulus that actually picks out the maximal value at 2. So differentiate this with time, and just consider the heat diffusion process. So you're looking at how these oscillations are decaying, and you wind up with this expression just by copying by rote this thing over. Now, we want to get this inequality. Maybe it's not so obvious initially, but the Hamming distance of Ay and from Ax based on this definition of A is still 2, right? You're flipping the same bit in both strings. Hamming distance is going to be preserved. Because Y and X achieve the modulus of continuity, the difference between this and this is always larger than the difference between this term and this term, term-wise, as long as you're using the same A. And so you can drop as many terms from this expression as you like. So as long as you're dropping them consistently, if I drop A, let's call it A naught here, I have to drop A naught here. And so we're just going to drop off all of the terms that we don't like, other than the ones that literally fall along the path connecting Y to X. So there's some other stuff. We don't care. Here's, I called this B naught. This is B1. This would be B1, and this would be B0. So this is some bit string given by Y, some bit string bit given by X. So these are some things we can keep around, and we can regroup them this way. And when we do this, well, B0Y equals B1X, that term is 0. B1Y equals B0X, that term is 0, and you're just left with negative 2 A to 2. Okay, so we know nothing about this function, but we do know that if we take it to be the first eigenstate, whatever that happens to be, because that thing is going to behave like e to the negative gamma t, well, you just differentiate, and you get that negative gamma a to 2 is less than or equal to negative 2 a to 2, or gamma is bigger than 2. Okay, so this is an optimal bound. You can't do better because that's the actual spectral gap. Okay, so this gets you there. It's really powerful. And we didn't really need too much information about what was going on behind the scenes. We just introduced this tool, and it did all the work for us. So now we want to go and extend this thing to a more general setting. And so the class of graphs that we're going to consider are homogeneous graphs. Now this is kind of a hand wave definition. Just think of a homogeneous graph as some graph where the edges are generated by some set K of group elements that do something to create your edges. And don't worry so much. It's basically somewhat of a generalization of a Cayley graph. And then we're going to consider basically the set of all convex subgraphs of whatever graph it is we chose. So just consider every convex subgraph. And what a convex subgraph is take your graph, pull out a bunch of vertices, whatever you like, make sure that all of your original shortest paths are included, and that's a convex subgraph. Okay, so then you just do some math, which I'm not going to put here. You get this operator expression, and you get that the decay is less than or equal to the action of the Laplacian, the path Laplacian on this function for this particular eta. So basically, the gap of this Hamiltonian corresponding to this thing is greater than or equal to the gap of the path. That is the diameter, path. So since I probably didn't say that well, let me say it again. If you consider your convex subgraph and then you let L path be the Laplacian for the diameter spanning subgraph of that, then the gap of the Hamiltonian corresponding to this S, the subgraph, is got to be bigger than the gap of that path. Okay, so this is basically what the result comes down to, and there's a couple of them. The first one I'd really like to draw attention to is you just in the pure graph theory setting, so ignoring quantum stuff for a while, we'll get to that down there. This is the best known bound. So we use this technique. This is a problem that's been worked on for probably 20 years, and the bounds typically start at the point 1 over 4 d squared. All right, so we're exceeding this by quite a bit because this scale is like pi squared over d squared. And these were mostly derived by Fan Cheng and S.T. Yao. Okay, so Cheng is a big graph theory person, and Yao is, I imagine most people know who Yao is. But not only do we get a better bound, it's entirely different in form, right? This is a much, much prettier, much more intuitive thing, because now we're comparing this structure to a substructure of itself, right? So we've got this really nice comparison theorem between this one structure that we were originally considering and some substructure, which is the diameter spanning substructure. So this bound is going to be as powerful as the host graph you choose to solve the problem. Now, as I said before, if you can get a handle on the gradient induced by your ground state, you can introduce what is known as a modulus of concavity. I'm not going to define that, but basically it's kind of like a modulus of continuity, where the more concave your function is over a particular different distance, the larger this this quantity gets. Right? So just consider a concave function, and you know, if it's really strongly peaked, you know, you get some big thing for small s, and then maybe it decays away at the boundaries. And this gets you a spectral gap for your Hamiltonian given by this expression. And so Stephen and I guess a few years back, derived this optimal bound for convex potentials on path graphs. And this, well, this is suboptimal, so it doesn't actually achieve that. And the suboptimality comes from the fact that you have to relax your math a bit, because you need to actually account for the gradients of your ground state. But you get this other term that depends on the cosh of this modulus of concavity. And so you can see that this, you know, as your modulus of concavity grows, this bound dominates this one very rapidly. So for these convex potentials on path graphs, you get that this thing really ramps up really quickly, and your bound is really controlled by this expression, not the other. Okay, so quick recap before I move on to things that are a little more practical. So heat diffusion, you know, it's clearly a very powerful way of really talking about this particular problem, but in general, these sorts of processes, right? It gives us a lot of intuition. But additionally, we can also derive, you know, previously unknown bounds, and they happen to be optimal. So this is basically as good as it gets. So it's definitely the best starting point. We also see that the ground state is going to induce a particular these particular directed weights on the graph. So it's going to induce this particular geometry. And then we get, now we should start looking into gradient estimates, right? These are things that people typically consider in like differential geometry, but they aren't often considered in a quantum setting, but they seem to be able to tell us quite a bit about what's going on in our Hamiltonian. So one thing you might consider is introducing a probabilistic notion of Ricci curvature for understanding quantum states. This at least makes sense when your quantum state is entirely real and positive in the substochastic setting. But, you know, it also kind of makes sense. Maybe you can make it make sense once you introduce complex values. You know, that'd be something interesting to explore. One moment while I fix my... Okay. But I promised you a classical algorithm. And you know, I'm going pretty quick, quicker than I anticipated. So if anybody has any questions this far, This is a natural point to take a bit of a break and respond. So before I change topics into something that derives from this but is a little bit different.
Yeah. So the homogeneous graphs. So what the bounds you had were just for the homogeneous graphs.
They're for convex subgraphs of homogeneous graphs.
Okay.
So that's any subgraph you can choose, where the vertices that you pick out, you maintain all of the shortest paths through the homogeneous graph. And actually, this is for invariants, but we're in a finite setting, so that's not something to worry about. I'm not concerned with infinite graphs. I'm not, you know, because we're not concerned with infinite Hamiltonians typically, or something finite. And so these bounds are going to be as good as basically, well, let me rephrase. These bounds are basically, if you can say that the graph you are thinking of is a subgraph of a homogeneous graph, then these bounds will apply. You don't have to say which homogeneous graph, you just have to say it's a subgraph of some homogeneous graph.
And is that something that's easy to tell?
Yeah, if the edges are generated by a group. I mean, it's basically, if you can say that, oh, my edges are generated by a group, these bounds will definitely apply, yeah.
Okay, I guess, okay, so the original how general is that? I mean, is it kind of most graphs are like this?
Well, so I mean, okay, the graph that we have in mind, obviously, and I mean, I'm sure you understand why, is the hypercube. So the hypercube obviously applies. I think a large set of physical things that are of physical interest correspond to this, right? Because you would have a group element, or you could represent your vertices by group elements, and then your edges are basically what can take you from one vertex to the next. So if you think of them as states or something. So you know, as long as you can do that, then you're pretty okay. If you introduce irregularities, so I mean, you could have a Hamiltonian with some irregularity where, like, say you pull out some particular state for some reason. And I don't have any physical thing in mind, but I guess there could be something and I'm just not thinking of. That's where it would fail. But I'm inclined to believe that most things of physical interest fall probably within this class.
Yeah, sorry, okay. I mean, you're thinking of a particular application of Hamiltonians.
Yeah, right.
I mean, but this is a purely graph theoretic result so far.
Oh, well, I mean, it also, I mean, this is all Hamiltonians too. Right, this is just all Hamiltonians. When I say the ground state wave function here, I mean the ground state of your Hamiltonian. It's just that we're talking about the substochastic Hamiltonian.
Right, no, I mean, but just thinking, you know, if
oh, in the abstract?
Comes and sees this result, how excited are they going to be?
Oh, I think a graph theorist would be pretty excited.
Uh-huh.
because, you know, I'm improving a bound that some of the best people in the field have really worked out by probably, I don't know, I guess it's a factor of 90, I guess pi squared over times 4, so 4 pi squared.
Sorry, so the previous bound was for general graphs or also?
The same exact class.
Same class. Okay.
So this is a class that's been highly studied, especially by Chung and Yao.
Okay.
That's one of the reasons why I considered it, is this is one like basic test case that you want to use for your methods. And then, you know, to get away from that, well, then the math gets a bit messier, but this is kind of a very good starting point for proving other bounds, right? And more or less, I guess, what I'm really trying to drive home, the best point is, this is really the best starting point you can get for deriving a gap bound, because some member of the class of things you're considering is always going to achieve this. And it kind of lets you throw away all but the most relevant one-dimensional information. So it takes something that's highly dimensional, projects it down to a one-dimensional space. And that particular one-dimensional space is a substructure of the original space, right? So, I mean, that's really what's going on here. And that's how you can get this sort of a bound, even in the one-dimensional case with this, where now you can introduce this modulus of concavity. So, I mean, part of the movement here, part of the intention, is to get away from talking about the physical potential and start talking about the structure of the, or the geometry of the ground state. And that was motivated also by the Cheeger stuff I mentioned earlier. Okay, so now we want to talk about a classical algorithm for simulating things. And this is where I hope I can convince you that substochastic processes are actually the thing we want to be comparing adiabatic optimization to, not simulated annealing. So consider the same heat diffusion process I set up to prove those bounds. Okay, so this is the solution to that same heat diffusion equation, and this F represents the same thing. Well, just like a Markov chain or whatever, you see that this thing decays exponentially with your gap, so in time. So as time gets big, that thing dies off, and you're left with something that approaches one. And so an adiabatic process, right, when you're varying your Hamiltonian, is something where F basically throughout the entire process stays very close to one, right? So, you know, we've got an unfortunate, in the classical case, in the heat diffusion case, exponential decay in time, just due to heat diffusion. But more importantly, you've got this F that's gonna stay close. So if you can marginalize, right, and just look at just, you know, renormalizing whatever's left, that process is what you want to be adiabatic. So we're going to think about this graph. We're going to think about heat diffusion on this graph. The W's here are going to be proportional to the cost function that, that we've introduced, the thing that we want to optimize over. And it's going to suggest the following strategy, which is basically drop some walkers on the graph. We want to look at what the probability of finding a particular walker at time t at a given site is. And we want to make sure that that walker is not dead. So infinity here just represents a transition to the cemetery state. And we're going to do this by considering this nasty beast, some marginal heat diffusion process. So this is a nonlinear differential equation. It looks a lot like Navier-Stokes. So if we could solve this thing, we'd win a Clay Prize or something. And so we're not going to attempt to solve it. We just want to know something about the adiabatic limit. But the nice thing about this is at least this part is just Schrödinger's equation with the I gone, right? It's the same exact thing. And all that this term does, and I didn't define sigma because it's just nasty, but the point is, all that this is doing is it's measuring, how much death is occurring. So whenever something dies, this basically replaces whoever died according to the current distribution, the current ground state distribution of your heat diffusion process, which is intuitively what you should be doing. And so this is the process you get out of considering this random walk process. Okay, so we need to come up with a way to do that, and that's what we want to do. Thankfully, this has an adiabatic limit, and it's a limit with gamma, the same gamma, because we have the same exact Hamiltonian, so it's got the same spectral gap all over. And when you expand this thing out and you do it up to order t squared, it's going 1 over t squared, rather, it's going to agree with the quantum process, so they have the same adiabatic limit. So our classical evolution is actually going to match the quantum evolution as long as we're far enough out in time. So as long as we're taking time to be about the same as we would expect time to be for the quantum process. Okay, so this is basically the algorithm. You start by dropping some random walkers down, 1, 2, wherever, and they walk around, and they take as much time as they take to walk around, and then you get to some intermediate time. These connections get a bit weaker, so there's less walking in the actual graph, but now there's a little bit of transitioning to the cemetery state. Whenever a walker transitions to the cemetery state, after each round, when a walker transitions to, or however many walkers have transitioned to the cemetery state, you take them, and then you just redistribute them according to whatever the current empirical distribution of your walkers happens to be, right? You're doing this adiabatically, so your current empirical distribution should be a reasonable approximation of the actual distribution, the actual ground state distribution, and so you just use that to replace your walkers. Some later time, now this is basically, you've got some walking still occurring along your graph, but most of what's going on is a death process, okay? So, and then at the end, all you've got is a death process. So at the very end, you've just got this death process, and you've got W, these are your different potentials. If one of them is zero, this will be broken so that there is one site, right, your optimum that is actually solving your problem. Okay. But big question, does it work? So here is a particular case that was studied in 2002 by Fari and Goldstone, and it's been recently extended by Kong and Crossan in 15. And this is a case that traps simulated annealing. So here what you've got is you have your hypercube or your adiabatic quantum adiabatic process on a hypercube, and you want to explore the hypercube and find the Hamming weight zero vertex, basically. And so the potential function that you introduce basically looks like this. W of a vertex V equals, and I'm just going to use H of V for the Hamming weight of V if H of V is not equal to D over 4, and that probably ran under the screen. Or D if, H of V does equal D over 4. So this is some spike that's located symmetrically throughout your space, and it's located at dimension D over 4. So I ran this on my laptop, and for the version of the problem that we considered, the spectral gap is about 1 over D, and it's a technical detail is why I didn't use the version where the spectral gap is like 2 or whatever it happens to be, but whatever. And so you see that, okay, when there's no spike and it's just the Hamming weight problem, we succeed with about 80% probability for what I chose to be 5D walkers and 5D squared time. And so that's scaling like gap squared in time and like something linear in the number of walkers you need. But importantly, we don't get trapped by the spike. In fact, we hardly feel it when we introduce the spike at d over 4. So we can just get right through it. And you know, now you should be asking, well, is it actually tunneling that's occurring? Is it something else? What's actually going on here? And I'll show you in a second a little image of what the process actually does. OK, so you might be interested in basically how this thing scales with the number of walkers. What you get here is this is the pure Hamming-Way problem, but you see the same thing occurred, you know, problem independently. You get some really sharp phase transition, basically in the runtime based upon the number of walkers, right? So you get this sharp spike where things start working, and you know, if you're under a certain density, you got to go a little bit farther out. But there's a trade-off between the runtime of one and the runtime of the other. Same thing for dimension 30 and 50. So you know, this isn't something that's just happening in low dimensions or whatever. This is happening across the different hypercube dimensions. And so this is a large space, you know, non-trivial success probability, but we are succeeding. And OK, so let me actually show you what the process is genuinely doing, since I have that. OK, so here's a GIF image. This is a low density of walkers. What you see in red is actually the instantaneous ground state. It's the idealized adiabatic process. It's not the quantum adiabatic process. My laptop would kill me if I tried to actually numerically get the genuine quantum adiabatic process. But what you can see is you know, this thing follows the ground state. And then when it gets to the barrier, it never actually crosses the barrier. It genuinely tunnels across, right? And what's going on there, I mean, I'll get into in a second, but it's really the population dynamics of the system that's driving it across this barrier. So population dynamics is going to recreate the effect of tunneling. And so for comparison, just so you could see it in a bit of a clearer, here's one where I synced up where they hit the barrier and, you know, saturated this in terms of walkers and whatever else you have, just so that, oh, that's really small. So I saturated the number of walkers here, so it gave you something clear. This is not how it would actually scale. I just rescaled it so you could see the appropriate behavior. So it is doing exactly what you would expect out of tunneling. And you're getting there pretty efficiently. So, okay, back to hold on one second while I try and, well, there it is. Okay, so what's going on here? Well, we had this picture before about the spectral gap. And so this is where everything kind of ties together. And you look back and you see, okay, this is actually the bottleneck of your substochastic process, right? The same spectral gap that you would be calculating for your quantum adiabatic process is the spectral gap that you're calculating for your substochastic process. And the same bottleneck is happening in exactly both places. So when you can experience tunneling in the quantum case is basically when you've got an exponentially small thing going on. I'm sorry, when you don't have an exponentially small bottleneck. That's what's going to kill you. But if you don't have an exponentially small bottleneck, the substochastic process has a non-trivial probability that some walker will make it across, right? So if you've got a population, they're dying, they're doing whatever they are, you've got a non-trivial probability that some walker actually stumbles across the barrier. Once one walker stumbles across the barrier, because the other side of the barrier is much more hospitable to the walkers than the other local the local optimum, they die really fast on one side, are reborn on the other side of the barrier, and it's effectively tunneling. You've got them all on the other side, and they can explore the entire space again. And then you just rinse, repeat. Right? So what's the potential doing here? Well, it's giving you the appropriate killing process to really describe what you're seeing, the substochastic process. So I guess there's a few take-homes. Specifically, populations, I think, should be able to, well, we've seen they can tunnel efficiently whenever we don't have exponentially small bottlenecks. The intuition as to why this happens is really, really clear. So Cheeger, you know, Cheeger basically says you've got a one-on-one correspondence between an exponentially small bottleneck and a non-trivial probability, I'm sorry, one-on-one correspondence between a lack of a bottleneck and a non-trivial probability of some walker making it across the barrier. Simulated annealing, which is just kind of this thermal algorithm, is probably not the right comparison at all for adiabatic optimization. Right? You probably really need to be comparing to the substochastic process, because that's the thing that really exhibits the same behavior, and it exhibits it classically. And you know, some other things that you can look at is the substochastic process is a really well-defined thing. It's not really this heuristic that simulated annealing is. So you can dig into it and dig into the theorems, and you can just avoid analyzing the gap altogether, because the quantities that you're playing with are the exact same quantities in both expressions, right? You've got Schrodinger's equation on one hand, and you've got an identical expression where all you did was erase the I from the equation on the other, right? So all of the quantities that are, all the matrices, everything are basically the same. So you can do a direct analysis. You don't have to talk about the gap. So there's still some open questions as to like how this actually relates to simulated annealing. Clearly, we know that we're going to succeed in cases where simulated annealing will fail, because that's been studied, and that was one of the examples I showed you. But you know, what about Metropolis or whatever? And then there's the big question, I guess, that when Daniel Ladar heard about this, he posed to me, was what about finite temperature, right? Because actual quantum annealers don't really operate at zero temperature. All this analysis is done at zero temperature. So what happens when you move to finite temperature? And you know, I just don't know. Maybe we get a speed up, maybe we don't. But we do have some other features that we can exploit here that give us some advantages over the quantum setting. For instance, we can monitor our death rate. We can right, all of these things are easy to monitor. They're kind of hard to get a handle on, and we can adjust our interpolation path, our path through the Hamiltonian space, based upon the behavior that we're actually seeing from our walkers. So this is something that you can't trivially do quantum mechanically, but we can kind of easily monitor algorithmically. So it kind of gives us an avenue to doing that. And there's some other, you know, open questions, but I'm happy to discuss those afterwards. I don't need to bore everybody with them. So I guess at this point, I'll just thank you, and also my funding. Yeah.
You have your, how big is the graph?
To the, that we've been working with, in this one, it's 2^80 I get up to.
Yeah, so, okay, so it's exponentially
yeah.
large graph.
Yeah.
Okay, so the walking, you have, but the number of walkers you have is smaller.
Yeah, well, it's 400.
Right, so that's like linear.
Yeah, that's right.
And so, so the way you implement this is you follow each of the walkers, basically?
I'm sorry?
So the way you would implement this is following the walkers, keep track of where they are in the graph? And then...
Well, so you don't really need... okay, yeah, I guess your walker knows where the walker is, and that's all that matters. You just have a list of walkers. I mean, I think this is what you're saying.
Yeah.
You just have a list of walkers, and you know, say 20 walkers die, you randomly choose 20 walkers from your list of remaining walkers. You have them respawn, you know, new walkers, and then you just continue on. And that's really all you do. But I mean, you're exploring an exponentially large space with you know, reasonably few walkers. I mean, you know, the probability that you're going to find this vertex at random is zero, right? Effectively. So I mean, obviously, we're doing much better than just a random search, but more importantly, and I mean, the real motivation behind this is we're really emulating what is done by the quantum adiabatic process, because we can use this population dynamic stuff. And oh, and the, I guess the other scaling that, you know, this is gap squared time. And sometimes, I mean, this actually isn't gap squared time, and this is less than gap squared time in this particular case. It's just that calculating the spectral gap of the 80 you know, it scales something like 1 over d. The spectral gap is actually smaller than whatever I used to get that, but, you know, I
can... And that, you know, when the gap is polynomial, that's
polynomial. Yes, right. But more importantly, it's the same runtime that the quantum adiabatic would take. So the only overhead you've got here is the overhead associated with the discretization in terms of walkers. And so I guess where this leaves you is questioning what the power of the quantum adiabatic algorithm is, if there is any. It's certainly, I'm on video, it's probably not tunneling, right? It's probably something else. And so some places you could look, I suppose, if you were so inclined, is the quantum states can implicitly compute their two norms. We're constrained to doing one norms, right? We don't have a good way, obviously, of implementing a replacement of walkers based on the two norm. We can only preserve the one norm. So maybe there's something to that. I really don't know. Let's see. Yeah, I mean, it's really puzzling where a stochastic Hamiltonian could possibly get its power at this point. I mean, the discretization is one thing.
Based on this, is there any reason to believe that a stochastic Hamiltonian has any super power?
Again, I'm on video, so I'll say the more modest thing and say, well, maybe, but if it does, it's only probably where things get exponentially bad in both cases anyway. That's the modest statement. And once I'm no longer being filmed.
Other questions? No, let's thank Michael.